Leader Yemen's Ansarullah movement says Israel is a threat to all Islamic nations and warns certain Muslim countries about normalizing ties with Tel Aviv. European powers in a joint statement urge Israel to halt settlement activity in the occupied West Bank. And polls close in Scotland's parliamentary elections, as all opinion polls suggest a strong victory for the pro-independent Scottish National Party. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says that Israel poses a threat to all Muslim nations.
They present a slogan of peace to try to divert attention from their crimes. The peace which they are presenting is not a real peace. What they want, their definition of peace, is surrender to them, only to try to exert and implement their own projects. And they want to kill hundreds of thousands of people. They come and they plant a Zionist entity in the heart of the region.
Abdel Malik al-Houthi warned certain Muslim nations about normalizing ties with Tel Aviv, saying the occupying regime will ultimately suffer defeat. He added that the enemy is deceiving a Muslim community into submission. He made the remarks on the occasion of International Goods Day. That's the last Friday of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan, which was designated by late founder of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, in 1979. On the day, people from around the world expressed support for and solidarity with Palestinians in the face of Israeli aggression. Yemenis have held a symposium in the capital Sana'a to highlight the importance of Palestinian cause among the people of the war-torn country. A symposium was held as part of events to mark International Quds Day in support of Palestinians, Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
The Palestinian cause between interaction and disappointment is the slogan of this symposium held in the Great Mosque of Yemen's capital Sana'a to raise awareness on the importance of the Palestinian cause among Yemenis. A number of state officials participated in the symposium.
The International Quds Day is an important occasion to remind the Islamic nations of the Palestinian cause. We call on the Islamic world to take steps to liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque from the Israeli occupation amid the continued acceleration of some Arab regimes to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
The participants affirmed that the Palestinian cause will remain the central issue of the Islamic nations despite the betrayal of some Arab regimes. They said Muslims should get united to help Palestinians to liberate their territories from Israeli occupation, especially the holy city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
For the Yemenis, the Palestinian cause is not restricted to the Palestinians alone. As Imam Khomeini said, we should prepare ourselves for the military step to eradicate the cancerous gland of Israel from the region.
The International Quds Day was initiated by late founder of the Islamic Republic to express support for the Palestinians and oppose Zionism and Israel.
Yemenis believe that the Palestinian cause is a global issue that requires all the free people of the world to stand by the Palestinians until the liberation of their occupied lands. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from the Great Mosque of Sana'a.
Palestinians lay to rest a teen killed by Israeli forces in the northern West Bank city of Nablus. According to Palestinian officials, the 16-year-old Syed Odeh died after being shot twice in the back in an Israeli army raid on Wednesday. An ambulance that was then prevented for over 15 minutes from accessing Odeh, who was pronounced dead upon arrival at the hospital. Palestinian Health Ministry said two others were also wounded by Israeli gunfire, one of them critically. Israel has tightened restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Jerusalem Al-Quds since the start of Ramadan, sparking a hike in tensions across the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have cracked down on protests against the curbs, leaving dozens of Palestinians injured. People in the Gaza Strip have held a rally to protest Israeli aggression against Palestinians in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem al-Quds, where dozens have been forced to leave their homes. Druba Shaba reports from Gaza.
The Palestinian National and Islamic Forces Committee in the Gaza Strip held a protest to support Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem al-Quds, where dozens of Palestinians are illegally displaced from their homes by force. In a press conference held during the protest, Palestinian leaders called on the international community to end this eviction that aims to demolish the Palestinian cause.
The apartheid policies and the displacement of Palestinians from their land is totally rejected by Palestinians. We stress that we won't allow the Nakba and the land grabbing that happened in 1978 to be repeated again. We are calling on the international community to stop these violations. We also call on all Palestinians to get united in order to end all Israeli conspiracies against Palestine.
Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip expressed solidarity with people in Sheikh Jarrah and held the Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of this move. In a recent statement by Hamas military wing, its leader Mohammed Daif warned that Israel will pay a heavy price if attacks against Sheikh Jarrah continue.
The message of the Palestinian resistance to the Israeli regime for these violations against our people is clear. Jerusalem al-Quds is our red line, and the resistance won't allow such crimes to go unpunished. The Israeli occupation will pay the price if the eviction in Jerusalem al-Quds continues.
As observers say, Palestinians are forcibly displaced from Sheikh Jarrah to make way for Jewish settlers. The Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah have been stepping up their campaign to save their families from eviction in recent weeks.
We are supporting our people in Jerusalem al-Quds. The current displacement of Palestinians is totally illegal, as those are the real owners of this land. This move aims to demolish the Palestinian cause and expand the Jewish settlements. The Israeli occupation should be held accountable for these crimes.
Similar rallies have been held by Palestinians against the eviction across occupied lands.
People here stress they are all united in defending Palestinian rights, and they won't remain silent over the illegal displacement of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Major European countries have called on Israel to halt its settlement construction in the occupied West Bank. In a joint statement, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Britain urged Tel Aviv to reverse the decision to build 540 settler units in the Har Homa area. The statement says construction of settlements in the area between East Jerusalem al-Quds and Bethlehem will further damage the prospects for a viable Palestinian state. The European statement comes as clashes erupt for a fifth straight night in al-Quds during protests against an Israeli court order for the eviction of over a dozen Palestinian families from the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Syria has once again denounced the Israeli regime's repeated attacks on its territory and sovereignty as a threat to regional stability and international peace and security. Bassem Sabah, a permanent representative of Syria to the United Nations, made the remarks in letters addressed to the UN Secretary General and President of the Security Council. Sabah slammed the latest Israeli attacks on Syria, saying they violate the principles of the world body's charter. He also warned about the consequences of the Security Council's negligence of its responsibilities to maintain international peace and security. The Israeli regime recently launched missiles on Syrian provinces of Kenyatta, Latakia, and Hama, killing one civilian and injuring six others. Joining us out of Damascus is Muhammad Ali from Mona Story. Hello, Mom. I hope you're safe and doing well. And we just talked about it yesterday, didn't we? That how many of these letters and pleas for this to be addressed the Damascus government has sent to the United Nations Security Council and the Secretary General, trying to get this basic blatant violation of the UN Charter addressed, to no avail. Your thoughts?
Yes, there is definitely a reason behind such letters. Now, if you ask why the Syrian government always sends such letters to the UN when there are Israeli attacks, while having no actually response on the ground, no measures taken by the UN to stop Israel from carrying out such attacks in the future. The reason is that, according to many analysts, Syria wants to send a message that it will continue to believe and abide by international law and international legitimacy, unlike Israel, which only abides by the law of the jungle. This is something said in previous statements by the Syrian government. The Syrian permanent representative at the United Nations sent two letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General, briefing them, as usual, on the Israeli attacks, which happened on the 5th and 6th of May on Latakia countryside in Musya, which killed a civilian and injured six others, and also caused material damage. The foreign ministry made it clear in those letters that those both Israeli attacks violate the principles of international law, UN Charter, and UN relevant resolutions, particularly resolutions on the disengagement of forces in the occupied Golan. The letters also stressed that the Israeli forces of occupation continue to benefit from what it described as the umbrella of protection provided by very well-known prominent state members of the United Nations Security Council, which encourages Israel to carry on with its occupation, aggression, and violation of international law. And this will continue to cause and constitute a threat to international and regional peace and security. The foreign ministry in its letters also warned the United Nations Security Council of the consequences of its negligence in preserving international peace and security, and also made it clear that Syria reserves its right and duty to use all possible means to confront such Israeli attacks. And finally, again and once again, the foreign ministry called on the UN body to shoulder its responsibilities and take measures in stopping any future Israeli attacks, and also to force Israel to implement the United Nations resolutions, particularly the ones about withdrawing from the occupied Syrian Golan.
And Mohammed, you mentioned that all options are on the table for the Syrian government, and it's tried everything it can to handle this diplomatically, and law is actually on the Damascus' side, and history is going to be ultimately on Damascus' side. My question to you, do you think that perhaps if the Damascus government didn't have his hands full fighting terrorists and the Turkish incursion to the north and the Kurdish and U.S. Incursion to the northeast, that possibly, and basically the Daesh incursion that over the last few years, which is now pretty much squashed, my question to you, do you think that the Damascus government had it its sovereignty and be a healthy country right now, would handle this threat from Israel differently?
Well, this is something that this is a question that should be asked to the Syrian government. But in my point of view, there are priorities for the Syrian government and for the Syrian army currently, which is now to fight terrorism. Syria is being attacked by terrorists from over 80 states. It has forces occupying its territories, like the U.S. forces, the Turkish forces, and the Israeli forces. The priority now is to eliminate terrorism. And in the point of view of the Syrian government, when the Syrian army attacks and kills terrorists, it is actually not just defeating terrorism, but defeating the supporters of terrorism, which are Israel, Turkey, and the United States. So the priority now, for sure, is to eliminate terrorism in Syria, regain full security and stability, and then look for other threats on the Syrian Arab Republic.
All right, buddy, stay safe. Always a pleasure to have you on. Get some rest there from Damascus. Muhammad Ali joining us. Iran's call for full implementation now of the Chemical Weapons Convention in an effective and non-discriminatory manner. Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations made the remarks while addressing a Security Council session on chemical weapons in Syria. Majid Takht-Ramachi stressed Western states are taking advantage of the convention to advance their political agenda, which in turn weakens the international treaty and undermines the legitimacy of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Iran's envoy called for forcing Israel to join that convention instead of pressuring states like Syria, which have given up all chemical weapons. Syria's envoy to the UN also slammed the recent decision by the OPCW to suspend his country's rights and privileges as a hostile act which resulted from the West's blackmail and pressure. Polls have closed in the Scottish parliamentary elections, which could result in the breakup of the United Kingdom. People in Scotland voted for 129 members to sit in on the Scottish Parliament. Vote counting will start Friday morning, with final results expected out Saturday. Recent polling suggests that the pro-independent Scottish National Party is on track for a majority. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, who leads that party, has pledged to call for another independence vote if her party gets a clear mandate. However, the British Premier Boris Johnson has repeatedly turned down that request for a second referendum. In 2014, Scots voted 55-45% to stay in the United Kingdom, but support for independence has grown since Britain's departure from the European Union.
Scotland is at a crossroads yet again. A historic election that'll set the course of economic recovery and possibly open up a path towards independence from the UK. But this election, too, divisions among the voters persist.
I guess what we're looking for is a little bit of autonomy from Westminster, says the English person. We're looking for better healthcare.
Positive change for everyone.
Big one for me is about the referendum. I don't want to go down that route again.
First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, whose Scottish Nationalist Party looks set to win, says her priority, first and foremost, will be the economy, but that if voters give her the mandate for another referendum, she won't hesitate.
I think it will unleash a permanent crisis. I mean, the growth of the SNP, the appetite for independence, although we didn't secure a majority during in DRF1, it doesn't show any sign of diminishing to any great extent. The numbers go up and down by 1 or 2 degrees. It's something which is almost permanent.
Parties hoping to scupper that plan, the Conservative, Labour and Liberal Democratic, who wish to stay in the UK. The SNP have been in power for more than a decade now, and they haven't exactly received praise for their performance in health and education, for example. But Nicola Sturgeon's response to the pandemic, her handling of the health crisis, has made her a popular leader, leaving many voters to forgive the SNP for their less successful performance in those other areas. If the SNP doesn't achieve a majority, Sturgeon could need to enter a coalition with other pro-independence parties for another referendum to become possible. Her next hurdle would be approval from British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who hasn't minced his words.
This is not the time to have a reckless and, I think, irresponsible second referendum. We had one only a few years ago.
The first independence referendum was held in 2014. Europhile Scots voted to remain part of the UK so they could stay in the European Union. But then came Brexit and changed that calculus. Now they're seeking re-accession, and the only way to re-enter the bloc is to exit the United Kingdom. Saeed Puriza, Edinburgh.
Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
و به توفیق الهی امت اسلامی و ملت مسلمان فلسطین بر دشمنان خودشون قطعا پیروز خواهند شد و خواهند دید اون روزی را که ریشه رژیم جعلی صهیونیست از سرزمین فلسطین کنده خواهد شد.
With God's grace and divine providence, the Islamic Ummah and the Palestinian nation will emerge victorious, inflicting a decisive defeat on their enemies, and we shall see the day when the fake Zionist regime will be uprooted once and for all from the land of Palestine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
In the limelight. A new commission is investigating Jair Bolsonaro's response to the pandemic, says Andrew Fishman, author, in an article titled Brazil seeks to hold Bolsonaro accountable for more than 400,000 COVID-19 deaths. Stay tuned for more. Brazil's COVID-19 crisis remains one of the worst in the world, and a brutal economic depression has forced millions into poverty. Opinion polls are for the first time consistently showing that a majority of Brazilians now disapprove of Bolsonaro. So far, Bolsonaro has proven adept at co-opting public institutions and avoiding accountability through threats, promises, backroom negotiations, or placing loyalists into official positions. But when Brazil's Senate launched a new inquiry into Bolsonaro's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, the president's allies were unable to block it. The panel convened for the first time recently, and members expect the investigation to produce impeachable evidence of his malfeasance. The commission appears ready for a serious probe into the coronavirus response in Brazil. It is a true health, economic, and political tragedy, and the main responsibility lies with the president, said Senator Humberto Costa, an opposition member of the commission. Costa, who is also a former health minister, told The Intercept that he believes there is enough evidence to conclude that Bolsonaro committed crimes against humanity, a label that other analysts have also used. With October 2022 presidential elections already looming, things could get worse for a man who has now spent years as an indomitable force in Brazilian politics. As Brazil moves closer to election season, anything is possible. The president's future will depend on his ability to maintain his tenuous alliances and the appearance of electability. He may finally be accountable, either in Congress or at the polls, for his dismal handling of the country's response to COVID-19, which had killed over 400,000 Brazilians in a recent account. Congressional leadership allied with Bolsonaro blocked congressional hearings into the government's handling of the pandemic for over a year, ignoring overwhelming evidence of its catastrophic consequences. Despite having enough signatures, the Senate commission that began recently only moved forward after a decision by the Supreme Court forced the issue. Bolsonaro was reportedly furious at the decision and openly lashed out against the justice responsible for ruling. The Brazilian media has already uncovered a slew of scandals related to the government's handling of the pandemic, which will provide the panel with much to look into. Additional investigative powers promise to provide even more public evidence of Bolsonaro's mishandling of the crisis. A detailed study of the government's COVID-19 response by the University of Sao Paulo and the Human Rights Group found that the Bolsonaro administration implemented an institutional strategy to propagate the virus, something the author said was intentional. Many influential voices, including Supreme Court Minister Gilmar Mendes, have referred to the government's actions as genocide since early in the crisis. This month, the Brazilian Bar Association argued that Bolsonaro is committing crimes against humanity. A similar case was submitted to the International Criminal Court last July by a coalition of groups representing over 1 million medical professionals. The Senate panel will review the evidence that led experts to draw these conclusions and has subpoena power to call witnesses and uncover official documents. Bolsonaro has done just about everything in his power to help the coronavirus kill as many Brazilians as possible. As president, he has forcefully discouraged mask use, rejected offers from vaccine manufacturers, fought against lockdowns, held back federal funds to fight the virus, actively promoted ineffective treatments with dangerous side effects, and slashed funding for science and health. When backed into a corner, he has repeatedly suggested that he could use the military to impose martial law or even undertake a coup d'etat if pushed too far. The Commission's role is to illuminate all dark areas in the fight against the pandemic, said Senator Renan Caro recently after being voted in as the Commission's rapporteur. The specter of the Commission, he said, has already accelerated a series of administrative measures in the last few days that had been frozen. Brazil, which is lagging behind in vaccinations, has suffered over 400,000 coronavirus-related deaths, one of the highest tolls in the world, and has become an international pariah as well as a prime breeding ground for new variants of the disease. The collapse of healthcare systems and overflowing symmetrics have made global headlines and spread the devastation across South America. Disentangling the who's, what's, and why's will be no easy task, especially as the president's allies will work to stymie the investigation at every turn. A particular interest will be revealing why Brazil ignored or rejected initial offers to procure millions of doses of vaccines on at least 11 separate occasions, as well as how much of Brazil's failure to combat the disease has been due to deliberate policy or administrative incompetence and ideological delusion. Costa, the senator, believes that Bolsonaro deliberately acted to spread the virus. The government decided that the best way to overcome the pandemic was to allow as many people as possible to be contaminated and thereby generate what is called natural immunity from infection without considering the damage this would cause, Costa said. He also attributed some decisions to the crude, intellectually limited vision of Bolsonaro and his government mixed with far-right ideological beliefs. Costa believes that the panel will conclude that impeachable offenses were committed by Bolsonaro, but is skeptical that it will result in impeachment. Unsurprisingly, the Brazilian economy faltered. The official unemployment rate is now a record 14.2% and in reality is likely much higher. The Brazilian real was the world's third worst performing currency last year as foreign investment fled the country and industries ground to a halt. New data suggests that 11 million Brazilians have crossed the line into extreme poverty since the pandemic began, a 45% increase, while the nation simultaneously minted 10 new billionaires. In an effort to hide the true extent of the economic carnage, the government recently cut 98% of the funding for the national census scheduled for this year, which could be canceled as a result.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, and our dear guests. Let me ask them to introduce themselves.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I am Zainab, totally stoked to be here with you guys.
Thank you. And, brother?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much. My name is Sayyid Ayman Rizvi, and I've been studying in the Hawza for the last 8 years, living in Qom.
Great. Sister Zainab, let me ask you this question, which some people like and some people dislike. Do you like to be judged?
Yes.
Very interesting. Why is it that you like it?
Oh, no.
Because lots of people, in fact, don't.
All right, so when you're being judged, you're either doing one of the two things. You're doing something right, and they're judging you, and that totally validifies what you've been doing. You know, they're judging you because they're either low-key jealous, or they're envious, or they wish they were in your place, you know? And I don't want to sound self-conceited or anything, but it kind of makes me feel like, it makes me feel encouraged for their judgment. Because here's the thing, decent, pious people aren't going to be the ones who pass judgment, right? Judgment usually comes from people who feel some sort of insecurity and defect within themselves and don't trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his decree and who he chooses to have favors toward over the other. Obviously, everything that I have is like, hada min fadli rabbi, it's from the grace of Allah. So if they be judging that, it's probably because, you know, they suffer from some sort of deficiency within themselves.
But sometimes they judge in a good way. They
don't. That's not called judging anymore.
So what is it then?
It's critical. It's it's constructive criticism. You know, that's different from being judging. Judging is when you label someone and you're like, you did that because you're that kind of person. Done. Khalas. Done. Deal. It's over with.
Yes.
And if someone like, supposedly we're doing this show and we're totally chilled and we're vibing and we're talking about all the cool stuff that we could be talking about, and someone comes and judges us like, and they're saying that, oh, who do they think they are passing their opinion about Islam? I'd be like, well, that's the whole objective, for us to voice our thoughts and our opinions. We're not calling ourselves experts. We just want to get it out there, right? So they could judge us and label us, or I could be doing something bad and someone judges me, right?
And then what?
And then, again, since they're not supposed to be doing it anyway, it's still more on them rather than me. I mean, sure, if I'm aware that I'm doing something mm-hmm. wrong, that kind of highlights it, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna fix myself.
But at don't you think
day,
that what they're doing through judgment, they're gonna complete you one way or another?
They're gonna what?
Complete you. Perfect you.
Yeah, so it's a good thing. Either way, judgment is hunkadory. It's so great.
Okay.
Yeah, let's judge each other left, right, and center. No, let's not do that. It's a horrible society where people are constantly judging each other. By judging, again, I mean labeling one another. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between judging someone and giving them constructive criticism,
yes,
and helping them
true.
Improve themselves. So if I'm doing something wrong and someone judges me and like, oh, you're so like immodest, or you're a horrible person for acting that way, I'd still be like, well, how about you look in the mirror? You're mm-hmm. passing judgment and you don't even know my backstory.
Mm-hmm.
So either way, I don't mind it when I'm judged.
Okay. Brother Iman, do you like to be judged?
Well, again,
how do you see it?
It's all circumstantial, you know. I mean, there are circumstances or situations that in which I think you can take the judgment against you, a thing through which you can improve yourself, you know. But sometimes, you know, it is not the same thing, same phenomena for every being, because maybe I can take the judgment strongly, mm-hmm. and you know, I can defend it. But there are some people who cannot take that judgment
definitely,
positively,
yeah.
and they get hurt.
Yeah, it
yes.
brings them
by
down.
The judgment,
it
yeah.
has the exact opposite effect on
exactly.
them.
Exactly. So
right.
I've seen it, you know, throughout my life that you know, you judge someone, you know, and then they got hurt, and they, you know, I think it's a really bad thing for those people who got judged.
But
and
bro,
didn't know.
Here's the thing about judgment. It's always on the judger, you know? It's still always on the person who's judging. It doesn't decrease my values. If I'm being judged, it doesn't make me less of a person. It just shows what kind of person they are, if anything.
You're talking about the reality of judgment,
yeah.
not what appears to other
exactly,
people.
Exactly, but if you could change our perspective toward it, you know?
Yes. That's
Let
the
haters
ideal.
Be haters.
That's the ideal.
Yeah.
But when you're living in the society, when you're mingling with people, and when you are subject to judgment on the part of like somebody, as you call the judger, and then there is the community who's judging you because of their judgment.
Exactly.
All right.
Usually so in our society, when you know, unfortunately, you know, to my background, I know that in Pakistan or India, usually parents or you know the elder people, they judge children very quickly.
They label
and based
them.
On their, they label them, and then from their childhood, they get lost.
Exactly.
So
oh,
this
you're
judgment,
a rebel. Oh, you're
yeah.
so lazy. Mm-hmm. You don't even study.
Exactly. So much. This is mm-hmm. this happens so much in Pakistan or India or you know somewhere else also as well, I guess. So this kind of a judgment is a very destructive.
That's how the child identifies himself
exactly.
from that point onwards.
So you know this. That's how you destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this kind of a judgment, we must refrain from it.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah.
All right.
I agree.
Sister Zainab, since you were differentiating between different kinds of like judgment, and also you saw it different from criticism.
Mm.
What Brother Eamon was talking about was that sometimes people get hurt through judgment
yeah.
of others. All right, but what about criticism? Even if how constructive it might be, it is still hurtful to some other
yeah.
people. All right, because of depending on many kinds of factors involved, like the person who gets judged is not like well developed
yep,
or
yep.
enough
or thick skinned.
Yes, but however constructive this criticism might be, they still get like burned.
Yeah, burned. All
right.
Exactly.
So how would you see that? Even the criticism.
Definitely. I feel it comes from judgment in their childhood. They were labeled and they were given a sentence, basically. You're lazy. You're not going to get anything done in your life. You're not going to have any achievements. You're not going to be successful. And this becomes this internal voice that the person, you know, speaks to themselves with, right? So they feel so very insecure. And that's why when they get older, later in life, they receive constructive criticism, but they can't process it. They can't differentiate between whether is this a label or is it actually an advice.
Mm-hmm.
And it shrinks them down and makes them feel so little, because if they go back to those days when they were judged and labeled by their parent, by their teacher, by their grandparents, by their neighbors, parents, sisters, uncles, cousin. And because it's this, I think the two things are so interwoven, and it all comes down to that, how we speak to ourselves, that internal voice that we have. I find that children that had judgmental parents that didn't give the children space to explore, you know, make mistakes and grow from it, and were constantly labeling them as being a failure and being a disappointment,
yes.
they can't take criticism for their life. And
yes.
rightfully so, they're so damaged, they're so broken. Every time someone tells them to do something differently, they feel like, oh my God, I am a piece of dirt. I am nothingness. I am worthless. Maybe my dad was right. I won't be successful ever. Look, I failed again.
What a loser.
You know, you're not a bad person for failing.
No one's perfect.
No one's perfect. And shout out to the parents who label their children that way. Dude, you gotta stop, man. It's unethical, psychologically, Islamic, from a social aspect, from any aspect that you look at it. We have to give people words of affirmation from an early stage in
yes.
their lives. So when they grow up and come to the society and their boss tells them, look, I don't want the report to be like this, change it, they don't go into full-blown mental
yeah.
breakdown.
Brother Eamon, any advice to those touchy people who cannot or did not develop a thick skin?
Get into media. My advice to them, if you ever ask me, is get into media. It'll give you a thick skin.
No, I think we must look up to Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, because they have given us everything. They have provided all the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to criticize someone, if you want to teach someone, follow Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says that if you want to improve someone, teach them in you know, closed space, like
exactly.
when there is no one else, right?
So true.
And if you want to destroy someone, teach them in
public,
front of everyone,
yeah.
teach them in public. So it's this sentence, I took this sentence, you know, as my guideline. Whenever I have taught my brothers, my younger brothers, or my children, I don't, you know, scold them in front of everybody. I see them doing wrong things, and I don't see anything.
Yeah.
But when we go home, reach home, and then when we have a
privacy,
I talk to them, explain them, and they understand, and they improve themselves.
Exactly, because they don't feel attacked.
Attacked, exactly.
They don't feel belittled. That is mm-hmm. so important.
They're very important. So I think if you follow Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, personally, I cannot give you any advice, and mm-hmm. every advice comes from Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. So if we really stick to them, I think we'll be okay. We'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. Sister Zainab, can you put yourself in the shoes of the judger? Why do they do that?
They're so insecure and broken. It's so sad. It's such a sad loop and cycle. I think the judger judges other people and passes judgment because they either envy that person or they feel something, like we said in the beginning of the show, they have this sort of insecurity, this sort of sense of self-loathe. I'm not good enough, so I'm going to bring down everyone else who's doing a good job so that we can all be at the same level of being crappy human beings. You know, that sense within them, and it's really sad because they were judged when they were young. They were constantly told that they're not going to achieve anything in life, and now when someone actually does achieve something, they're like, how dare you achieve them? I'm going to judge you so bad until you fail, just like I have, you know? And
don't you think that they do have this kind of, like, not negative aspect that you are adding to them, all right? I'm saying that maybe they have something like a good intention when they do this.
They have good intentions, but they are very stupid in their choice of words, I'd say.
Probably.
If I could be totally blunt about it. They want to say something, but, you know, they have the wrong choice of words. They could have said it more gently. They could have been kinder. They could have been more intelligent in
or
their choice of words.
Or they could have taken you
aside. Exactly.
Not in public.
Exactly. And, you know, passing judgment is one of the most horrible things that we can do as a society. And the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, they forbid us from it so bad. There's this beautiful and touching hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. He addresses Malik al-Ashtar, and he says, "Oh Malik, if you see someone sinning at night, don't look at them with the same eyes in the morning, because they might have repented throughout the night and you didn't see." So we can never say, "Oh, sinner," and label them. They have those, you know, those lonely moments with their Lord,
yes.
and they have a heart-to-heart with God, and they might have repented, and you didn't see that moment. You
exactly.
just saw them at their
exactly.
worst. So don't generalize. Don't judge them on that. And I think we need to practice, like, for
and
the judges.
And sometimes appearances are deceptive.
Oh, so much. But then again, a hadith do tell us that, like, don't put yourself in a situation where you will be accused,
uh-huh.
you know? So
yes.
be careful of your own actions.
Exactly. Thank you, Sister Zainab. Brother Iman, don't you think that it depends on many factors? I mean, being judgmental, like, for example, take culture as an example.
Yeah.
All right? Doesn't it depend on the culture of the people you are associating with? Do you think it's innate or inherent in us?
You're talking about to judge, like for a judger?
Yes.
Of course. There are many factors to it. I think, society. Society also contribute to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And society is basically, make up your mind to take such actions.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's from family.
Yes.
You know, you have seen always in your family that your father is judging
everyone
else. You just learn
it. The neighbors, his cousins,
yeah, exactly.
everyone.
We have so many examples like that. So there are so many factors which contribute to this, you know, this sort of a character. So, yeah, you're right.
I find it really sad that Islamic societies and communities have become or have been judgmental. I find it really, really sad. On one hand, we're like, oh, Islam is the religion of peace. Oh, Islam is the religion of mercy. And you're like, you're butchering a human being with your words and your judgments and your labels.
Because it has nothing to do with Islam, you mean?
Yeah.
It's the exact
opposite of what Islam tells us to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for listening to the program Back to Reality on RIB English Radio.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al Alameen. يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمارة زكاة يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي أمى رائزك لتصي دليلتك وانسك.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The late African-American Muslim minister and human rights activist Malcolm X once suggested that the United States should be prosecuted for the genocidal situation facing black Americans at the United Nations. Decades later, and in the wake of brutal U.S. policing, the United States is now facing similar questions and similar criticisms. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan. Richard Sudan is a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, U.S. Police Killing of Black People Are Indeed a Crime Against Humanity. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sudan's article. For years, the United States has been readily quick to point the finger of blame at other countries and highlight alleged crimes against humanity. This claim is almost always followed by subsequent plans to militarily invade a country, usually in Africa or Middle East, in order to steal resources and to install the US version of so-called democracy. This pattern has continued playing out decade after decade, despite masses of people around the world becoming ever wise to the repeated pretext used by the United States and its allies to justify boots on the ground in countries in which their armed forces are simply not welcome. But now, a damning report produced by a group of international human rights experts has turned the tables on the narrative used by the United States. And as much of world opinion and perception of the country begins to shift, has placed the question of alleged crimes against humanity squarely back within the country's own borders. A special report produced by a commission of experts from 11 countries, which runs to 188 pages, has suggested that the continued systematic killing of African Americans in the United States by police and law enforcement not only amounts to murder, but also fits the definition of crime against humanity, the very same favored assertion which the United States unflinchingly directs towards other countries, often without real substantive evidence. But the new research, which is extensive, argues that the deadly abuse of black people at the hands of law enforcement in the United States amounts to a violation of human rights obligations, whilst operating a culture of impunity around police suspected of murdering black people. The report also points to the U.S. tolerating an alarming national pattern of disproportionate use of deadly force against African Americans. But not only that, the lawyers behind the research are also demanding that the International Criminal Court, the ICC, conduct an immediate investigation into the continued abuse of black people in the United States, describing the cycle of abuse as police murder and torture. For those who are familiar with the phenomena of deadly force in the United States, leading to continual grief and anguish in the black community, the report is welcome, concise, and importantly, is added vindication to what experts and activists have been arguing for many years. In the same way that deeply entrenched and systemic white supremacy has been revealed for the world to see, especially over the last few months, even acknowledged by the FBI, this new report gives the United States government, which has always backed the police force, nowhere to hide, as international focus, momentum, and demands for justice continue to reverberate and be amplified around the world. But one thing which is likely to be certain is that the findings from this new report will be completely ignored by the U.S. government, which many argue has taken next to no decisive action at all in dealing with the systematic and ongoing abuse of African American and blacks in the United States. While President Joe Biden opportunistically rode the coattails of the black vote in the United States to narrowly beat former President Donald Trump to the White House last November, and while promising on election night to have the backs of the black community, millions view him as having seriously reneged on that promise. Following the murder of George Floyd last year by former police officer Derek Chauvin, millions of people around the world have been closely scrutinizing the United States and asking questions. How can a country which describes itself as a so-called flag bearer of democracy claim to be one when it continues to brutalize and mistreat its own black citizens, whose descendants built the country? This is a valid question indeed. The late African-American Muslim minister and human rights activist Malcolm X once suggested that the United States should be prosecuted at the United Nations for the genocidal situation facing black Americans. Decades later, and in the wake of brutal U.S. policing, the United States is now facing similar questions and similar criticisms. And perhaps these calls will continue to grow louder, because the deaths of black people at the hands of the state are unrelenting. During and since the trial of Derek Chauvin, dozens more deaths have occurred by uniformed police officers, sparking widespread outrage, including the death of a teenage girl, Makia Bryant. The irrefutable fact is, the United States is in no moral position to speak about crimes against humanity until it gets its own house in order. The U.S. simply must prioritize ending once and for all the systematic killing of African American, particularly men, women, and children, at the hands of law enforcement and police, and bring about swift, restorative justice to black communities which deserve nothing less. Democratic Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley says black people are traumatized in the United States, and Derek Chauvin's guilty verdict in Minneapolis hasn't changed anything for them. Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer who knelt on the neck of George Floyd, leading to Floyd's death in May of 2020, has been found guilty on all charges that he faced. The verdict was read in Hennepin County Court recently as Black Lives Matter activists hit the streets to protest rampant police brutality in the United States. Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all three criminal counts he was facing. He faces up to 40 years imprisonment for second-degree murder, up to 25 years for third-degree murder, and up to 10 years for second-degree manslaughter. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley wrote an article recently for USA Today where she said that the outcome of the Derek Chauvin trial doesn't change things for us because black people are still being killed by police. Ayanna Pressley wrote, "I want to wake up feeling lighter, but I don't. I want to wake up fearing less for the safety of my black husband and black daughter, but I don't. I want to wake up and see nice days for black community, but I don't. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, but I can't. It's a new day in America, but our communities are still facing the same traumas as before." She added, "What I want my colleagues in Congress and at every level of government to understand is that the only thing that matters in this moment is meaningful policy change and budget change, period. It's time to put our money where our mouth is and invest in resources that provide the restorative, trauma-informed, community-based solutions people are demanding. Our communities have already lost too much." Ayanna Pressley concluded by saying, "George Floyd was not a martyr. His life was not meant to be a sacrifice. He was a regular person who woke up on a regular morning, went to a regular store, and was murdered in broad daylight, on camera, by regular police. He was somebody. He deserved to grow old." A US-based journalist and political analyst said, "The surge in violence against people of color in the United States is a systemic problem rooted in the legacy of slavery and legalized segregation in the U.S. In a recent interview, Dr. Abayomi Asikiwe said the police practices employed in the United States today have their origins in the slave patrols of the 19th century that were designed to keep incarcerated Africans under the control of white landowners, white merchants and officials.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.